Hey everyone, welcome to the Compass Podcast. Today, I am joined by author Andy Edstrom. Some of you may know him from the book that he has written, Why Buy Bitcoin? If you haven't read it, I definitely recommend it. It is a great foray into investing in Bitcoin. And I'm excited to really dive into a great conversation with Andy about what he makes of everything that's going on now with all of the new interest and everyone that's now paying attention to this new asset class, which if you're listening to the show, you are probably among those who are Bitcoin believers, maybe even maximalists. So some of what we discuss, I'm sure, is going to resonate with you. And maybe you can, you know, add this arrow to your quiver when you're having conversations with normies, trying to express to them the importance of why buy Bitcoin. So without further ado, we're going to get into the show. I'm really looking forward to this conversation with Andy. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. If you do, please consider subscribing and leaving a review on your preferred listening platform. It really helps out the show. The Compass Podcast is presented commercial-free by Compass, the number one Bitcoin mining marketplace. If you want to get started mining Bitcoin, source hard-to-find ASICs, or find competitively priced hosting space, then check Compass out at compassmining.io. And now, on to the show. Andy, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Whit, great to be with you. Appreciate you having the conversation with me.
Really looking forward to it. The book, and look, there's a lot of great literature out about Bitcoin, but really, I think the best books are the ones that are palatable and make it easy for people to understand why they should place their time, effort, or resources into Bitcoin. So what was it that led you to writing this book in the first place?
Yeah, so I started my journey in 2017. I was the usual third exposure, you know, case, right? Read an article in The Economist in 2013 about Bitcoin, totally went over my head. Read an article in the Wall Street Journal, I think, about Ethereum in 2016 after the hard fork, the DAO fork.
Okay.
Totally went over my head, ignored it. And then a smart friend of mine, Arun Rao, you know, basically pulled on my shirt and put it on my radar in kind of probably second quarter 2017. And then I finally did my homework or started my homework and got involved in the third quarter of 2017. So I made the usual hero's journey through all the altcoins, all the junk coins. I always kept, you know, my Bitcoin, as far as my personal portfolio, Bitcoin was always my largest position and always has been. But I kind of had to make it through that whole process and the bubble and all of that stuff.
Sure.
And after, you know, the sort of the final dump in late 2018, it got to be January of 2019 and Bitcoin was at 3,200, I think. And I decided to put pen to paper. And it was partly an exercise to strengthen my own conviction and really, you know, test the thesis. In other words, I'd been through the cycle in 2017. I had held all the way through. I had actually added, right? I was stacking sats 2018, you know, not consistently, but in several chunks. By the way, stacking sats at prices and then watching the price go lower, right?
Yes.
every painful purchase, staring at a loss. And so I kind of got to the point where I was like, all right, it's beat down. I do believe in it strongly as an investment. I want to get my clients involved. You know, am I right, basically? And then I realized also, okay, if I'm going to get my clients involved, because I'm a wealth manager, well, I'm going to have to put the thesis on paper. And if I'm going to do that, I might as well do it for a larger audience.
Sure.
And the first draft was more technical, but I decided to, you know, basically make every effort to make it open and accessible to a broader audience, both for, you know, my friends and family, for my clients. I mean, this was an opportunity that I thought was not to be missed. It was an opportunity that I didn't expect to see, you know, maybe more than once a decade or even once a lifetime. And so, yeah, for various reasons, I decided to write the book. All those reasons.
So you write the book, you put it out. Are the first people that get it your clients?
Well, more or less. I mean, basically it published live. I think it was live on Amazon on September 2nd of 2019. And yes, I basically immediately ordered copies and sent them to my clients. And obviously I sent an announcement email. And so that was the first stage. It was only probably 3 months later that I actually started, you know, kind of getting out there to promote it. I started tweeting, right? I was a lurker on Twitter until December. December of 2019 was my first, you know, basically my first tweet. And, you know, it was the announcement of the book. And yeah, that's when I started sort of, you know, pounding the pavement a little to get the word out.
So now as a wealth manager, obviously, you've got great relationships with these people who trust you with their money. When it comes to Bitcoin, how does this impact those relationships? Do you initially, are you the crazy guy who now it's the trust is questionable, or we're pretty or your client's pretty open?
Yeah, no. So look, it was, all of this was somewhat strategic and or tactical with respect to managing my clients, for sure. I mean, if I had been, you know, like I said, I started writing the book in January. This is, you know, you can't make this stuff up, right? Literally at the bottom, literally at the bottom in terms of price. And I realized that if I bought it then, you know, I could get thrown out the window, basically, right? The defenestrations would begin. So I knew I needed the thesis to back it up. I also honestly recognized that probably we needed to see a bottom. In other words, it was going to be real hard to convince normie clients, you know, to buy this thing at 3K or 4K after this massive, you know, 85% down move or whatever it was from the from that prior peak. So it helped, A, to have the book out by September, and B, it helped to have, you know, somewhat higher price, let's be honest.
Sure.
And so the conversations, I'm sure, could have been much tougher. There were still a few tough skeptical ones, but it, honestly, and I knew, or I had a feeling that this was the way it would go, which is why I, you know, as soon as I put out the book and then bought for clients, you know, and the ones that started asking questions, I said, here, right, read this first. I sent it, each of them a copy, obviously. And after you've read it, you know, let's have a conversation. And some, I'm sure, ignored it. A number of them read it. I got a lot of actually really good feedback. And it was a good conversation piece and conversation starter and level setting for a lot of them, because just like everybody else, myself included, well, I say everybody, I mean, God bless the Austrians who've been all over, sure, this stuff, you know, for years and years. I mean, yes. God, I wish I'd had the benefit of that exposure, that education, but I didn't. So like most other people, understanding what is money and starting with that was really pretty critical. And so the book obviously, you know, lays the foundation for what is money, what is the state of the world in terms of debt in the context of the global financial crisis, you know, which I had lived through professionally, did live through professionally. And then, okay, what are the basics of Bitcoin? Here's, you know, what's just enough technical explanation to hopefully make it stick. And then, of course, what's all the laundry list of risks and or FUD, you know, the investor, you know, the classically trained value investor like me has the risk section of the book, but I call it 40 pages of FUD, because what you know and what I know is that most of those risks are technically risks, but they are so minuscule and or so misunderstood that it's really not worth worrying much about them.
But now in the book, those risks that you talk about, whether it's, you know, regulation or quantum computing, in the time since you've written the book, how have those evolved or changed with regards to how they're being communicated to your clients now that we're at 60K and not 3,500?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I mean, I had four categories: political risks, economic risks, technical risks, and then sociological and psychological risks. Mm-hmm. And each of those has its own, you know, set of risks. And you named a couple of them. Definitely, I would say that the set of risks in terms of, you know, the binary, like, is it on the list or not on the list, mm-hmm, probably hasn't changed much. I would say that the political risk looks reduced. In other words, I took the view at the time that it was pretty low probability that governments would try to do really bad things to, sure, either Bitcoin itself or people holding Bitcoin or miners for that, yeah, you know, for that matter. But yeah, the last couple years of events, basically, in facts and circumstances, have obviously de-risked or indicated, let's put it this way, there's little or no indication that governments are trying to, you know, hamper Bitcoin in any significant way. So I would say, right, that risk is reduced. You mentioned quantum. Quantum is an interesting one. I mean, I would say quantum is still there, and it's, you know, it's only closer. The risk is only closer in the sense that there's a number of companies I'm aware of, like, I don't know, probably 8 or 10 of them that are building larger and larger qubit machines. Now, mm-hmm, are we faster? Is that on track, or like, has it happened faster or slower than anticipated? I don't know. I think that risk, quote unquote, is still out there, but it doesn't worry me much. And sure, I guess what I would argue is, as market cap has increased, that just makes it, I mean, while it increases the attack, you know, sort of the honeypot, mm-hmm, on the other hand, it also greatly increases you know, basically the benefit, let's say the necessity to come up with a quantum proof solution. In other words, if you look back 2 years, you'd say, okay, there will be a solution to the quantum attack vector on public key cryptography because so much rides on it already, right? Like basically all of internet commerce. But with multi-trillion dollar Bitcoin, let's look ahead a few years, we're already at $1 trillion. That is potentially at least as large in magnitude of a incentive, let's say, for cryptographers to find a solution. So yeah, the bigger it gets, the more payoff or the more necessary it is to come up with a quantum hard solution that can get forked in at a later date, again, even assuming it's required. So I guess I could argue that's a positive.
Well, and you know, one risk that I think in 2019 and before that was out there, especially for, you know, institutions, is the liquidity, right? If I take a sizable position in Bitcoin and it starts to go down, am I trapped in my position? Am I going to be able to, you know, cut my losses and get out? And I think that for all the hate and the venom that was spewed at Elon Musk over the past, you know, 48 hours, I think that this was a great show that there is liquidity. You can exit a sizable position of Bitcoin very quickly, cost effectively, and albeit very public in his case, generally it doesn't need to make a lot of noise.
I agree completely. And this is I'm glad you raised this factor. This is one of the things, I don't know if I underestimated it, but if I wind back the clock a couple years, it's been interesting, let's say, to watch the evolution of the institutional involvement at different scales. And so, you know, wind back the clock to 2017 and I don't know, Novogratz and everyone else were like, the institutions are coming, right? It's happening. And the counter argument is what you just made, which is there's a certain class of institutions, maybe it's pensions, you know, maybe it's ultimately central banks. You know, basically it's endowments, potentially it's large investors that literally can't touch Bitcoin until it's over $1 trillion because of liquidity. Right. I'm assuming, by the way, that the liquidity is a sort of derivative or direct corollary or correlation to the market cap.
Sure.
And so, yeah, so we've seen these waves of adoption, and it really does seem to have been based on the liquidity needs of that class of investor. So obviously the family offices and the hedge funds were early, and then the corporates are happening now, or already started happening last year, I mean, in size, obviously. And then, yeah, we've still got these incremental classes of investors that are still poking around, coming in. You know, the insurance companies are getting their feet wet. And that is one of the genius characteristics of this market, which I just wonder if, you know, somehow Satoshi could have foreseen, is that there would just be incremental larger and larger categories of demand for this thing from investors that just needed and had, you know, needed more liquidity and had higher minimum thresholds. So it really is a case of the bigger it gets, the more demand there is. Amazing.
Imagine that, right? Working as that. It should.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're at this stage now where it seems like, I mean, everyone's talking about Bitcoin. Everyone's got an interest in it. It's top of mind for governments, institutions, retail, literally everyone. You have to be living under a rock to be, you know, to be missing this wave that we're seeing. But now from your perspective, being that, you know, some of the heavy lifting when it comes to investing in Bitcoin is probably already done for you, do you find that now new clients are coming in and actually asking for exposure to Bitcoin?
Yes, absolutely. So it's almost a tale of two groups. It's sort of in the wide world of wealth management, you know, there's tens of trillions of dollars of assets, and there's all kinds of clients, large, small, rich, poor, you know, old, young, you know, different profiles in terms of, you know, hands off versus hands on. I mean, there's just all this opportunity out there. And I have found that there is a segment of the population that's paying attention to Bitcoin, and they are interested in finding a wealth manager who they think understands it. And then there's also the category, which is one of my favorites, and I've had lots of conversations to folks like this, which is large, you know, decent sized stack Bitcoiners, okay, who are pretty convicted like I am that still we're going to see significantly higher prices in dollar terms, right? Like the bull market ain't close to over, probably. And they're thinking about, and I'm thinking about for them, hey, you know, you're whatever, 95%+ of your net worth is in this single asset. Mm-hmm. At some point in the future, are you going to want to, you know, take a little bit off the table and diversify? And I know that's heresy to some listeners, but yeah, there are people who never thought they were going to be wealthy or, you know, didn't anticipate that they would become wealthy as fast as they did with Bitcoin. And as they say, with the, you know, with wealth generation, to get rich, you concentrate your portfolio, and to stay rich, you diversify. And so some of them are thinking about, hey, I'd like to stay rich. And, you know, as well as maybe I want to sleep better at night. You know, I don't really want to suffer through another bear market if that happens, which is, you know, still my base case assumption. And so they're thinking about, yeah, you know, like at what price, you know, am I peeling some off at, you know, pick a price in the six figures in terms of USD. Sure. And so, yeah, so there's a couple of categories of inbound that I'm getting. One is those people with significant stack that may look to diversify later, you know, or need financial advice. And then another is those who know that Bitcoin is going to be a real part of the future. And they just want to make sure their wealth manager is thinking about it, knowledgeable about it, and understand its importance in the context of a portfolio, which is greater than we think, I think, than most people realize.
Well, now, when it comes to diversification, aside from just Bitcoin exposure directly, you've got GBTC, there's ETFs, there's, you know, public mining stocks. So what does this look like, or how do these factor in when you're talking to clients? Or is it just that, look, hey, there's Bitcoin, and then there's these others that are not Bitcoin, but still give you some measured exposure?
Yeah. So that's obviously evolving over time. And it's interesting to think about, because when you wind back the clock, even 6 months, even like 4 months, I mean, the number of new products and alternatives that has come to market kind of makes your head spin, right? I've got this spreadsheet, which is like, you know, Bitcoin, you know, methods for getting Bitcoin exposure for clients. And each column, right, is a different, you know, fund or organization or solution. And I haven't been able to keep up, to be honest with you, right? Oh. I try to keep stats on, you know, who the sponsor is, what the fee structure is, you know, what the, you know, logistics are, who are the third party providers, you know, like the auditor. I mean, all the stuff that you would want to know as an investor in one of these vehicles. And that spreadsheet just keeps getting bigger. It's almost unmanageable at this point. So yeah, so the number of products that's come to market is enormous. And that's, by the way, just in the category of Bitcoin exposure. And when you, yeah, layer on sort of proxies, you know, whether it's MicroStrategy or, you know, other companies with big balance sheet exposure, or it's the mining companies, there's a whole world of opportunity there. I am still biased. I have been biased toward, and still am biased toward, direct, or I shouldn't say direct exposure, but as direct as possible exposure to the underlying, to Bitcoin itself, as opposed to, you know, individual mining stock names. I feel that the risk-adjusted return available to holding Bitcoin still probably significantly exceeds, you know, anything else out there in terms of other proxies, or in terms of the quote-unquote crypto space, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. Could that change? Yeah, I mean, you know, nothing is certain. But probably what you know and what I know and what many listeners know, hopefully, is that the thing about Bitcoin is it's still king, and there's a reason it's still king, and it's hiding in plain sight. It's right in front of you, people. There's all these whiz-bangy alternatives and ways to get exposure, but on a risk-adjusted basis, I still think Bitcoin is the best opportunity. And then I'll caveat, and I'll say, in terms of like the publicly traded mining names, you know, in theory, there's probably value there. There may be really interesting risk-adjusted, you know, opportunities there. I mean, if I wind back the clock, certainly I wish that I had seen in advance the prospect that the huge supply chain, you know, disruption and inability to get rigs basically would accrue in dramatic fashion, right? Yes. To some of these public mining names. So I have some regret there. You know, I wish I'd bought them either for my clients or myself or both. Yeah, so I guess I could argue that was a missed opportunity, but going forward, that's kind of what I see at the moment.
You know, it's funny with the public mining stocks, and really anything outside of Bitcoin, because I don't know, I look at them like a trade as opposed to Bitcoin, yep. which is the store of value. And you can argue it's a medium of exchange, but I still see it as my safe harbor, right? If I'm going to make a trade and exit out into fiat, that fiat's going to go into Bitcoin, right? If I'm going to save resources for later in life, those savings are going to be in Bitcoin, right?
Yep.
So I think that the public mining companies, the ETFs, GBTC, it's a nice primer. And I think that it helps people understand that, you know, anything tangential to Bitcoin itself can provide great returns. But ultimately, at the end of the day, when you're exiting out of any trade, in my mind, you want to be, you know, exiting to Bitcoin.
Yeah. And I'll just, you know, just to riff on it a little more. I mean, people come to me, you know, they're pitching mining startups, basically, you know, stranded nat gas, you know, production, you know, that's the low cost, you know, anchor for, you know, basically building a mining business on top of. And I have no doubt there's opportunity in those, you know, in those areas, or, you know, different mining models, whether it's yours or anyone else's, but the layers of complexity and risk, you know, the execution risk, you know, picking the management team, you know, the all the risks come with a startup. Because let's be honest, most of these things are still effectively startups. Not all of them, yes. but many. Like that is all you could do that as an investor. You could do that as a full-time job. I mean, the layers of complexity and the dynamics within the mining market. You know, if I spent, you know, 80 hours a week just analyzing those opportunities, you know, I might be lucky to, you know, to pick the right ones. So, yeah, it's definitely a higher level of complexity. And I'm sure there's opportunity there. But me sitting in my seat, you know, that gaining that edge or gaining that alpha is likely to be very difficult.
Well, I mean, investing in mining companies is also not the most attractive returns, right? Right now, when everyone's looking to place capital, and there's so many opportunities for venture style returns, venture type of returns, your 10s, 20xs, mining companies generally don't provide that, right? If you're looking at building infrastructure, it's capital heavy, right? There's a ton of CapEx that goes into that. And you mentioned the execution risk. That's the biggest. I mean, we see these decks and we see these people that are building these companies, and God bless them. I love the initiative and the drive, but despite ASICs being plug and play, everything else is not. You know, building a data center, figuring out how heat dissipation works, making sure that you're, even if you're drawing natural gas, how your gen sets operate, all of those things, they add such complexity, which is why you have, you know, like Great American Mining or Crusoe or Upstream Data. I mean, these guys, their 100% focus is on this specific industry, and they built it in the bear market, which, you know, was not the sexiest time to build, and they had to bootstrap a lot of it themselves and figure it out as they went, and it just makes them more resilient now.
Absolutely. And everything you just mentioned, which are sort of the technical elements of managing a data center business, which itself is like a fully developed field, right? There's
yep.
That's hard.
Yes.
Those engineering problems are hard. Then, of course, you layer on the complexity level of the energy, you know, topography, basically the whole grid layout, you know, all the various potential sources, you know, the dynamics of what direction are these various classes of energy moving in terms of their development, either in the US or in other jurisdictions. And it's like, wow, that's to be good and expert in that field. Yeah, truly would be a full-time job and a half.
Yes. Slight pivot here, but I want to talk about your take on Michael Saylor, MicroStrategy, and the them entering the market. What are your thoughts on how that has impacted things?
I mean, obviously, it was a watershed event. When the history books are written about the year 2020 in Bitcoin, and they will be written about, that will be written about in major history books, because, you know, you work backwards and you say, what will be considered the most important things that happened in, you know, in the history of the early 21st century? Bitcoin was for sure one of them. Okay, yep. Well, what were the major events in Bitcoin? Well, there was that inflection point in 2020, in the bull market of 2020. And what were the major drivers? Now, he's not the only one, but clearly he's a major one. And so, you know, he is one of the best pitchmen I have ever seen in my, you know, life, investing career, mm-hmm. in any industry. I'm not just talking about Bitcoin.
Sure.
And he's working for Bitcoin. So that's good. We got the strongest, you know, sales force, sales team member in the world, probably.
He even converted Hope.com to a Bitcoin resource database.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I love also that he has, when you dig into his personal history and his knowledge, you realize that he has credibility, you know, behind the thesis. I mean, obviously, when he pitches or when he just talks about it, the things he talks about and the way he talks about them give high confidence that he knows what he's talking about, right? Now, on the other hand, as an investor, as we're always trying to peel through the, you know, get around the sales pitch and you know, try to dig into what's substantive.
Sure. Well,
if you dig into his background, he has all these pieces that give him credibility in terms of his ability to judge that Bitcoin, you know, is this huge opportunity, right? Because he studied the history of science. He's been a, you know, an entrepreneur and CEO in the software business for decades.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, also he wrote this book called The Mobile Wave in 2012, which people should read. I have. It's very good. I mean, a lot of the stuff that he said would happen in the subsequent 8 or 9 years has happened. And a lot of it's based on the internet and network dynamics. And so he has all these, he has this knowledge base and this history. And then you mentioned the domain names, right? So like, of course, yeah, he understands scarcity on the internet.
Right.
He was smart enough to buy all these, basic domain names, excellent domain names, which he's now pointed at Bitcoin. Like the guy clearly understands the internet and internet native phenomena. And so, yeah, he has huge credibility and he's made a big difference.
So where do you think in this cycle, as we're moving forward, price volatility is something that has often been viewed as a negative. As a wealth manager, how do you feel about volatility and how are you communicating, whether it's positive or negative, about price volatility to your clients?
Yeah. So I love that you asked about the volatility because it is a crucial point for investors, you know, for new people into the space, basically for everyone. I did used to think that the volatility was a bug, and I have come to the view that it is a feature. And here's why. So the first is, you know, one of the things I did in my book, which others have done as well, is the classic sort of analysis of a portfolio. What does a portfolio look like with Bitcoin and without Bitcoin in terms of both return and risk? And of course, the answer is if you size it right, and if you have a diversified multi-asset portfolio, then Bitcoin has added to the return substantially without adding risk. Or if you're careful about the construction, you can set it up so that it reduces the risk. Okay. Amazing. Amazing as a portfolio construction tool. So if you take the right view on portfolio construction, you realize that the volatility is, you know, is really not, it's not that big a problem. Okay. The second thing that makes the volatility beneficial is it's not money. I'm saying that, you know, jokingly, right? The central bankers, the economists, they all talk about how volatile it is, and therefore it can't be a medium of exchange, and therefore it's not money. To which I say, great. We Bitcoiners will just be off here in the corner working on this thing that's not money. And in another decade or two, surprise, surprise, people might actually use it as a medium of exchange once it's at least an order of magnitude bigger, maybe two orders of magnitude bigger. And the vol has, you know, reduced over time and people are willing to part with it, right? Because they don't want to just, you know, hodl it because they know the value is going up, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So that's the other benefit of, or another benefit of the volatility. Third benefit of the volatility is, you know, I was sitting with a mutual fund manager, investor, last week, I think. And he was talking about, oh, you know, won't it get manipulated like the gold market? You know, won't the shorts be able to beat down the price? And my answer to that, you know, it is a risk. It's actually something I talk about in the book. And the answer to that is good luck, right? One of the benefits of having such volatility in this thing, especially to the upside, is that if you go short in too much size, you get taken out to the woodshed.
Exactly.
You get wrecked. You get blown up. The volatility actually, in some ways, makes the market safer. And I could argue in general, I mean, who knows for sure what caused the recent, you know, downturn. And then now we're looking at a recovery. But it looks like a bunch of, you know, levered traders got liquidated. And that's a good thing for the development of the market. The fact that there is risk that you get liquidated if you use leverage makes it less likely that you're going to get into a position where the layers of leverage that are built on top of Bitcoin basically threaten its functioning or threaten its existence. So I think the volatility is a significant net positive, and that is a hard argument to make to most people. And it's not what I, you know, it's not the view that I held when I was first getting involved. And I think that a few brilliant people probably realize it quickly, but for most of the rest of us, it just takes time and deep thought and understanding about the market dynamics to reach that conclusion about Bitcoin bull. I'm curious what you think.
So I started as a trader before getting into mining. So I love volatility. Mm-hmm. All of your money is made in volatile markets. If everything is stagnant, you have to be very, very, very good as a trader as volatility decreases. But with increased volatility, your ability to swing and you know win trades it's easier. You can buy on the way up when it's already up 5% and know it's going to run another 30%. And on the way down, you're able to get out of a trade a little bit faster if you're wise with your scenarios. So I've always been a fan of it. From the mining side, volatility is fantastic because especially when we're dealing with hardware that's in short supply, volatility ensures that people who really are the biggest believers and the best prepared with their capital are able to be in the best position. So if I have a lot of capital, but I deploy it inefficiently at a time when the market is, you know, on its way up and I'm overpaying for these ASICs, yep, then I'm going to pay that price when the market turns and I'm now sitting on hardware that is overvalued. And the inverse is also true. If you have a lot of capital and the market turns and you've been waiting for this chance to buy the dip, you will get that ability to do so. And, you know, fortunately, because of volatility, that's able to occur. If everything was, let's say, operating within a range of, you know, $100 or $500, there's not going to be any changes to the up or the downside. And it's ultimately just going to lead the people who have the biggest capital stack to win. It wouldn't matter. You could deploy capital every third day of the month. Mm-hmm. And you would win because you would be able to, you know, outbuy everyone else. And it wouldn't have anything to do with the skill or the timing with the market. It would just be, you know, I've got a fat wad of cash that I can spend and you can't. So,
yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned I think that's an interesting perspective on, you know, from the mining side and then from the trading side, it's the pro con of how many hardcore hodlers, Bitcoin hodlers, you know, found Bitcoin because of the trading opportunity. you know, fortunately or unfortunately, maybe it's unfortunately, usually the way it's gone in bull markets like we're in now is, yeah, that's how a lot of the retail comes in, right? They think they can be a pro trader, or some percentage of them thinks they could be a pro trader. And then, of course, they get wrecked in the subsequent shakeout.
Yes.
And and of course, they try to do it on altcoins because altcoins have even more vol, and, you know, ABC junk coin is going to be the next Bitcoin, which I still hear from pro investors without naming him. One of these mutual fund guys that I was talking to recently was like, man, I'm really interested in finding the next Bitcoin. And I'm like, dude,
you're easy.
You're smarter than this. You should be smarter. Anyway, so it's interesting to think about how much interest in the sector. You know, there's no counterfactual, obviously, but how much interest in the sector and how much learning happened as a result of the vol and the trading opportunity.
All right. Well, this conversation could definitely go on for much longer, but we do have to wrap up here pretty soon. Before we do, though, Andy, what I want to know: bull market, everything's mooning. We're all living the high life, planning to come down to Miami. Everyone's getting yachts and throwing parties and preparing for the party that will be Bitcoin 2021. What has you most excited about this market right now?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I mean, look, obviously I'm excited to accumulate more returns in terms of, you know, purchasing power. I won't say in terms of dollars or euros or yen, but let's just say, you know, the real value of the network. I do expect the network value to go up more and soon, right? Probably this year. So there's that. I am excited for mainstreaming. It's been, you know, a little cold out. It was a little cold out in the wilderness of this latest, you know, bear market. It was painful being involved in, you know, the time between 2017 and today, although that pain has been much reduced in the last 6 months. But look, I mean, I've got an ego. Like, I'm happy to look right. I looked like a lunatic when I published my book and Bitcoin was started writing at 3,000 and published it, you know, in late 2019. At least to some people, I looked like a lunatic. So, it's nice to see the thesis bear out. I'm also really excited for people to stretch their minds, you know, look behind the curtain. I mean, what we learn in Bitcoin is that so many things that we took for granted were wrong, or at least we weren't understanding them right. And so I'm still getting inbound, you know, friends and family. family, talking about, you know, environmental FUD and various other factors. And so I'm excited to watch these people on their journey toward understanding, you know, the reality of what this thing is and what it's likely to mean for the world. And I'm excited to, you know, do my small part basically to help them on that journey. And likewise, I'm excited to learn from the whole community. I mean, the whole community has been so amazing, so welcoming. I mean, I just feel happy and lucky to be here.
It's fantastic. Well said. Well, Andy, I am grateful that you were able to make time to come on the show. Before we sign off here, though, please let everyone know how they can find you. And also, audio version of the book is available. So
yes, it is.
Let everyone know how they can find it.
Yeah, of course. So the book is called Why Buy Bitcoin? Subtitles, Investing Today in the Money of Tomorrow. It's on Amazon. It's on Apple. You know, most places you can get a book, you'll find it. Thank you, Whit, for pointing out that the audio is available. Our excellent Bitcoiner mutual friend, Damian Somerset, did the work on that, and it turned out great. I'm real happy with it. And, you know, I can be found, obviously, on Twitter. Handle is Edstrom Andrew. It's last name and first name, Edstrom Andrew. And, yeah, check out, you know, Stack Some Sats with Swan Bitcoin, swanbitcoin.com/Andy, because I think that, A, we should all be stacking sats as a personal policy, and B, I don't think this bull market is anywhere near being over with. So I still think accumulation now and for the long term makes all the sense in the world.
Boom. Mic drop. Andy, thank you so much. And to the listeners out there, we appreciate you guys for tuning into the Compass Podcast. We'll talk to you guys all again very soon. That's a wrap for us at the Compass Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please subscribe and consider leaving us a 5-star review on your preferred listening platform. Thanks again, everyone. The thoughts and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests on the Compass Podcast are their own and do not represent the opinions of Compass Mining, Inc. None of this content should be considered financial advice.